Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Everyday Anarchism. This is a continuing episode in the discussions on debt, inspired by David Graeber's book, Debt. And my guest today is James Galbraith. He's a professor at UT Austin in economics or anti-economics. How would you describe your work? Can we start there?
Well, actually, I have no appointment in the economics department and haven't held such an appointment since a year at the University of Maryland very long ago, 1979, 1980. So I hold my main appointments in the LBJ School of Public Affairs. I've always been a policy person, and in the Department of Government, where I have basically an honorary appointment. So this gives me the license and the capacity to speak on the subjects that you're interested in, basically with impunity. People may not like it, but they can't do anything to me.
Well, that's wonderful to hear. I thought we could just start with this issue that you and I were discussing a little bit, of this concept of economics as a field. It has this set of, I know you've described it as, and I completely agree with this, an outgrowth of moral philosophy of the 18th century. It's less a science and more a set of views about how the world should or perhaps must be organized. And those of us who don't like how the world is organized, it seems like we have to somehow challenge economics as a field in order to make our way in this world.
Well, economics as it presently is, I would modestly modify the way you've just described it by saying that the kind of economics that has become dominant in the last 50 years is actually a retreat from the 19th century. It is not continuous through this period. It does, to some extent, go back to the 18th century theological concepts, that is to say, even earlier. I mean, actually, come to think of it, where does supply and demand come from? It originates with Adam Smith, who was strongly influenced by his voyages in France and his discussions with the physiocrats, notably François Quesnay. And Quesnay was deeply influenced in intellectual life in that period by his study of the philosophy of ancient China. Not surprisingly, because that philosophy, it was a yin and yang, is supply and demand in some sense. There's a cousinship between these things, opposing forces that give you balance, which enable there to be harmony under the guidance of a celestially inspired emperor, which was in some sense the official court philosophy of pre-revolutionary France. But then, you know, sometime after Smith, this got rather upset by the unfortunate occurrence of the French Revolution. And at the same time, in scientific fields or over the course of the next half century, the rise of evolutionary doctrines, Darwin publishing in 1859, and the rise, a parallel rise of concepts in physics that suggested that the cosmos did not consist of a stable set of entities, but rather had evolutionary properties as well, something which became embedded in physics a little later on, second law of thermodynamics in particular. And all of these things created, you know, I would regard Marx as a step along the way toward adopting economics to the scientific spirit of his own time. All of this created terrific problems for the alliance between academic economics and the teaching about business practices and so forth, and, you know, governing elites, which always like to believe themselves as having reached a state of permanence and legitimacy. And so in the late 19th century, it was a rollback against evolutionism, against institutionalism, and that eventually, a century later in the 1970s, completely drove away all of the progressive tendencies that had actually been a strong part of academic economics in the middle of the 20th century. So my father's time, listeners will not be mistaken in associating me with a Galbraith of another era. The department that my father served in at Harvard was an exceedingly diverse and interesting group of people. It included people who had done state planning at the highest level, someone like Vasily Leontief, people who had done, who were doing economic history, people who had done, who had basically participated or guided the wartime mobilization of the United States, people who had been involved in the New Deal at various levels. These were people who had strong links between them, their academic discipline pursuits and the their work in the real world. And they were very intellectually diverse and interesting. This was the big mistake I made, was that thinking as I was growing up that the economics profession would continue to be as interesting as it was in the Cambridge of the 1950s and 60s. Also the visitors from Europe at that time. And, oh, okay, so I've been disillusioned, but I got stuck. Therefore, I'm a professor in a kind of intellectual time warp, stuck on a desert island, if you like, a rather nice island, but one which is highly isolated from in the middle of a very barren ocean of mainstream economics.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I just want to jump in there and say, for someone like me, the work you are doing, the resonances it has with the work of David Graeber, and obviously the work of another era, your father, and then, of course, the greatest or one of the two or three greatest economists of all time, J.M. Keynes, would just be, you know, totally out of place in the field of economics as it exists now. You are perhaps an isolated island within the field of economics, but it seems to me that the post-70s field of economics itself, that's the weird, strange, isolated island that's divorced from
all of the other fields. Well, I would call it the barren ocean, highly acidified and devoid of interesting marine life. The corals have all been bleached. And I may be an outpost of a sunken continent. So you say Atlantis went down and I got stuck on a small remnant of it. But Graeber, for example, is a very interesting and admirable case and greatly missed at this point. He was an anthropologist. And anthropology was an evolutionary science. So if you pick up common antecedents of people like David Graeber, and for that matter, my own father, you can go back to Thorstein Veblen. Veblen was certainly an economist of huge importance, strongly of the view that economics and anthropology were essentially sister disciplines, and they were rooted in evolutionary principles. That's what they were all about, was about how societies change over time. And of course, Graeber's emphasis on debt. What is debt? Graeber knew, and as Keynes knew when he wrote the Treatise on Money, is a contract. It's something where you get resources in the present in return for commitments in the future. And so it's a way of binding people to certain obligations and disciplining them, but also giving them opportunities in which some, of course, succeed and accumulate, and many others are then cast back into the semi-darkness of having obligations that they have great difficulty meeting. And this is a mechanism for social control. Graeber saw this very clearly and writes about it as going back thousands of years. Keynes saw it very clearly. If you take the mainstream economics, well, you ask, where are financial institutions, where are banks? Where is time in this theory? You have a really hard time finding it. Where is money? One of the great puzzles of the generation of general equilibrium theorists that was operating when I spent a year at Cambridge in the early middle 1970s was, how can you fit money into a general equilibrium model? Kenneth Arrow, Frank Hahn puzzled over this and said, no, you can't do it. Basically, you can't do it. It's not a commodity. And their model was about the exchange of commodities. So we just have to pretend that it doesn't exist. Well, if you're going to base your theory on that, you're going to end up not being able to understand things like the financial crisis of 2008. I mean, or for that matter, the great crash of 1929. These little ass shocks to the system, things that, as was said at the time, nobody could have foreseen. Nobody could have foreseen, unless, of course, you spent some time studying the actual function of credit markets, in which case, if you were, you would be like Hyman Minsky, you would be constantly asking not if things are going to happen again, but when they're going to happen again, and what might actually trigger them.
I'm so fascinated by this. I mean, as the listeners, I'm sure, are tired of hearing me say, I'm an intellectual historian of late 19th and early 20th century ideas, and this, the way that evolution transformed all of them and similar processes in things like physics. I mean, that has been the basis of all of my work. I am somehow taken aback at this idea that is now so clear and evident to me that this ocean that you're talking about of mainstream economics is precisely a lifeless ocean. It is an attempt to find something in which there can be no process of change and adaptation, which every field of study, including from every realm, the social sciences, the humanities, and the sciences, has been transformed out of stasis into flux by Darwin, if not people sooner. And the reason why the field of economics has to, you know, pretend that money doesn't exist is because that could force people to
think in time,
change, and sure, that simply can't be done in the field of economics. If I'm understanding you correctly, and this is just so enlightening.
I think we're very much on the same wavelength. I like to say that, it is often said that there were two schools of mainstream economics, the saltwater school and the freshwater school. And this references to MIT and Berkeley, let's say, or Stanford on the coasts, and Chicago on the Great Lakes. And I say both of those, saltwater and freshwater, are relatively sterile. Where evolution happens is in the backwater. Actually, I think I entitled one of the talks I gave when I was closely associated as president for a while of the Association for Evolutionary Economics for a year. And I got the Veblen Commons Award. Now, I think it was that talk that I entitled The Backwater Economics. That's where things change. That's where you have. There's a discussion in Clarence Ayres on the theory of economic progress. It's an important book published in 1944. Ayres was a Texas economist. He lived just a few blocks from where I live now. He makes the point that the development of new systems happens on frontiers. It happened in Europe because that was the edge of what had formerly been the Roman Empire. It happened in the Caribbean because the feudal arrangements of Europe did not apply on the sugar plantations. And so you could, and this is, I think, very much part of Graeber's analysis as well, but Carrie Polanyi, and now a centenarian in Montreal. I was up celebrating her birthday last summer. Remarkable work on this. What happened in the Caribbean was that purely commercial operations and the institution of slavery, which was very old, became a capitalist institution par excellence, with capital goods, human beings being the capital goods, on the Caribbean islands and ultimately in the southern part of the United States and in Brazil, but it was the Caribbean first. Ayres talks about Texas in particular as was a frontier region in the mid-19th century as having distinctive capacities. And institutions build up and become somewhat rigidified in places like, well, Cambridge, Massachusetts, where I grew up. Well, Austin was once a frontier. I'm not sure it still is. In fact, I'm pretty sure it isn't, but it liked to think of itself as a frontier. Perhaps still was when I got here in the 1980s to a degree. So that's all, I think, very much in line. But I can't leave off this particular thought without reminding you of this extraordinary essay of Veblen's in 1898 on why is economics not an evolutionary science. And I think, at the risk of completely alienating your listeners, I can recite my favorite sentence from that essay, which goes, if we are weary under the taxonomy of a monocotyledonous wage doctrine and a cryptogamic theory of interest with involucidal and maniloform variants, where is the centrosome cytoplasm or theory of karyokinetic process to which we may turn and in which we may find surcease from the metaphysics of normality and controlling principles? I really think if you can put that sentence to memory and look up all the words and think about what Veblen was meaning, you grasp the difference between a static and an evolutionary analysis. But yeah, it may be asking for too much.
Well, I mean, are you willing to do this work for us, James, or does the listener have to do it on their own?
I think the readers really ought to dig out that essay. It's available online. Read it through. Okay. There are many great passages, but that really, to me, is, I don't think a better sentence or a more Veblenian sentence certainly exists in the entire canon.
I will. I'll put a link to it in the show notes. That I should continue asking you, but I'm struck by, I think he's technically a sociologist, the sort of doctrine of social Darwinism, economic social Darwinism in America comes from this guy, William Graham Sumner, who...
Oh, yes. Sumner was one of my father's favorite characters, along with Herbert Spencer. Yeah. And Veblen was Sumner's student, actually.
Oh, I didn't know Sumner, that. I should have known that.
Yeah, at Yale. So this was, of course, one discreditable branch of the influence of Darwin. Would, you know, say, okay, well, yes, everything's evolutionary, and the rich are rich because, well, God wished them to be rich. Well, of course, it's not quite evolutionary, and that was not how Veblen cast the question in The Theory of the Leisure Class, let's just say, by a long shot. But it was a very popular form of justification of the wealthy. I highly recommend the take that my father did on this for the BBC in 1977, which has been more or less pirated and can be found on YouTube. The Age of Uncertainty has a great museum of natural history in which, amongst the dinosaurs and the other exotic specimens, there's Capitalopithecus robustus as the evolution of the human toward the guy in the top hat with the vest and the bulging stomach. This very much captured that particular offshoot. But it wasn't what, for those who haven't, who really want to get into this in a very engaging way, I have to recommend Louis Menon's book, The Metaphysical Club, which is just a very, very erudite, but also just highly readable. It's a treatment of the intellectual climate in Cambridge, Massachusetts, actually in the blocks in where I was born and grew up, on either side of Francis Avenue, Charles Saunders Pierce, William James, and others in that circle who were bringing the notions of materialism, of evolution, the Darwin's ideas, into American philosophy, and yielding ultimately pragmatism and progressivism and the pluralism, dispensing with the notion that amongst other things, blacks and whites were created separately, which is an attempt to justify the whole slave system. The role of the Civil War in modernizing and people's attitudes in this country gives you a very good introduction to the way in which thought advanced and led to the 20th century. And if you look then at mainstream economics, you discover it's not there. Those thoughts are not present. That whole sensibility has been rolled back to something very desiccated and abstracted, covered up with a gloss of really rather elementary but not easily penetrable mathematics, and designed, I think, to give students a set of puzzles or a set of games to play and to overcome their natural common sense in order to make them more less critical and more amenable to the world in which we presently live. That gets to the observation you were making a few seconds ago, which is, if you look at a modern university, economics department's rather hermetically sealed off from most of everything else. They don't come to the seminars. There are no broad-based intellectual activity. Very, very few of the professional economists find it worth their while to attend those, and very few people from other disciplines make their way over to an economics department because they have nothing in common. That the sociologists, the anthropologists, the physicists, the biologists, the engineers, they do, the people who are working on energy problems or environmental problems, they do have things in common with each other. But the economists really operate in a closed off intellectual world.
I'm totally struck by that. And again, that's why it's relatively hard to find someone with a background in economics to even have these conversations with. I mean, this is something that Graeber encountered when he wrote People said, I'm not even going to read this book because it's obviously wrong, because it runs contrary to the principles of economics. The idea that the principles of economics might need to be subject to, we could say, evolutionary pressures are just like subject to
horrors. Perish the thought. Go wash your mouth with soap, young man. You will not get tenure in our department.
Yeah, well, Graeber didn't even get tenure in his own department the first go round. I think something you said about the mathematics and the puzzles is a good place to start. And we can talk about debt. I mean, this book, Debt, that Graeber wrote, and the movement Occupy Wall Street that he was a member of and that has revived. I mean, my students were just asking about this. Well, first they said, what is Occupy Wall Street? Because I'd given them a reading that referenced Occupy Wall Street. So this is out there, a warning to everyone above the age of 30. Undergraduates don't know what Occupy Wall Street is. Right. So just just fair warning.
One of my children was the librarian for Occupy Wall Street. After they cleared it, they broke it up. The next night, I spoke to the crowd in the park. And I have to say, I talked about the importance of the library as a symbol of what you need to do. Is you really, particularly in this country, the business of keeping yourself educated about things that people don't want you to know is really very important. But I had to draw a point of continuity. So I did. There was this particular method, which I haven't seen much of since. They didn't have loudspeakers. So you would say a few things and then the crowd would relay it to the people. It was really great. I mean, it was so in this mode, I told a story of something that happened to me when I was 16 years old. And I was in Chicago, this is August of 1968, Democratic National Convention, where I had a number of close brushes. So I didn't have a bad experience personally, but a lot of people did with the Chicago police. And I was in the hotel facing Grant Park, which was the McCarthy headquarters and one of the places where there was a massive police attack on the protesters. And I was there when the National Guard came and surrounded the protesters, a vast number of jeeps and submachine guns and this kind of thing. And the following morning, my father went down and talked to the protesters from the podium, and he gestured over to the National Guard, and he said, "I don't want you going to try conclusions with those young men over there. They're draft dodgers just like you." Came down off the podium, and a sergeant came up to him, and he thought to himself, "Galbraith, I think maybe you went too far." And the young sergeant stuck out his hand and said, "Professor, I just want to shake your hand. That's the nicest thing anybody's said about us all day." Anyway, you could see that the police who were surrounding Zuccotti Park appreciated that as well. And it could be nice, have a nice evening from one of those as we left.
I want to believe in an evolutionary world in which everything is in flux, but this sounds like these two stories separated by what, close to 50 years, 40 years are strangely resonant with one another. We're just enacting these scenes of protest and repression over and over again.
Well, there's a point at which, and I'm actually just writing something about this, which I'm just working on a little text to bring up another anniversary that will soon be at the 60th anniversary of President Kennedy's assassination, about which we have been telling ourselves, or if you are a member of the American elite, you have to pretend to believe a certain story, which almost nobody else believes. And certainly nobody outside the United States believes, nor has for many, many years. The way I'm just working on wrapping up this piece is to say eventually reality is going to catch up with you. You can't run a society based upon a structure that is profoundly at odds with the way the real world actually works and expect that your elites who have to bow their heads and tug their forelocks and so forth in front of that set of doctrines are going to maintain the quality that's required to run the society effectively. And that's what's happened, I think, in the United States. And I think, come back to the story of the Kennedy cover-up is a piece of that. But I think the broader structure of this is reflected in the way people are expected to accept the doctrines of mainstream economics. These are doctrines which are not compatible with life processes. They are out of sync with the way everything works in the world. And if you want a one-sentence summary of why, it's because they're now compatible with the second law of thermodynamics, which gives you our sense of time. Many, many ways that one can elaborate that theme. I'm interested in it particularly because with a mathematician, a man by the name of Jing Chen, who I've been working with for quite a long time now, we have a book that's going to come out, I think, next year called Entropy Economics, the Biophysical Basis of Value and Production. The basic thesis of the book is that there is a unity between biological, physical, and economic processes, and that they're all parts of systems which have to extract resources from the environment. They have to do so with a surplus. They have to build a fixed structure before they can invest resources, and they have to maintain that fixed structure, and they have to be viable. And once you understand that's true of biological organisms, you're tapping into the entropy flow. The entropy flow is the source of all life. It's true of mechanical processes, your automobile, nuclear reactor, airplane, anything you name. It's all about getting energy from the environment and building a structure that can make use of that energy, differentials, but without melting down or blowing up, which is why you need regulation. And economic societies, well, the parallel entity is or laws, regulation, governments. And that's what you need in order to make sure that the extraction of economic resources doesn't lead to a social breakdown. And you can tie in the measurement of inequality to this. Inequality, the degree of inequality that a society tolerates, is a very important regulatory device. It can't be zero, because all activity requires differentials, right? That's Cournot's principle, temperature, pressure, you know, and economic opportunity. And none of us in real life have ever exceeded in being just average. We don't want to be. We all want to be a little better. My students who are very idealistic are all about equality. I say, okay, you know, but be realistic. Why are you in graduate school? It's because you want an opportunity that you didn't have before. The real question is not whether there will be inequality or not, but how much and what degree of insecurity and precarity. My friend Albena Asmanova has brought this word, I think, into focus, which is not the same thing as inequality, but it's closer to describing what people's psychological states are. How much of that does a society tolerate before it becomes really dysfunctional? You can measure at least some aspects of this. Measurements have done, I think, well, which has been a project of mine for a long time, will give you, I think, a pretty good guide to the better or worse places to be an ordinary person in the modern world. Once one puts these things into a frame that is compatible with every other aspect of life and physical processes, then you have an ability to understand economics much more clearly. You know, I'm not the first person to have this idea. Georgescu Regan had it in 1971. Keynes certainly had it. So we're looking, Veblen had it. It's an uphill battle to make it accessible to a larger audience and to renew its accessibility to the generations that are coming down the pike.
I mean, it strikes me as absolutely a fully empirical idea and an idea that, I mean, it sounds like the 19th century. I mean, I think William James and John Dewey have both embraced a version of this idea. And I'm really struck as you're speaking of the way that this kind of thinking has gone out of fashion. It's even probably would be described as pseudoscience, even though I think its scientific bearing.
It wouldn't be described as pseudoscience by anybody who's an actual scientist. And this is the problem with our colleagues who are invested in the mainstream doctrine, is that there is a tendency to ring fence any fundamental challenge and to treat any discussion at this level with just with disdain and dismissal and contempt. We get this all the time. David Graeber got it, as you were describing. My father got it, although his access to an audience made him into a sui generis kind of figure that he was not able to be perturbed by the views of that generation of academic economists, and he never lost his position or his equipoise. He went on to be much more concerned with, you know, the issues of things like nuclear war, which were important questions. There's no reason to feel sorry for him, although the fact is that people came along and said he's not really an economist.
So Richard Rorty has written about that for, you know, most of these 19th century figures. They're not really a blank. You know, William James isn't really a philosopher. Durkheim isn't really a sociologist. When you get these kind of sterile ring fencing around disciplines, the people who are the foundational people for those of us who are from outside of the discipline often get excluded from the discipline. I have lots of negative things to say about the English department, but one positive thing I'll say about the English department writ broadly is we have a tendency to take these people in. Your Thorsten Veblens and your William Jameses, when they get kicked out of their own discipline, we will read them. And then everyone will accuse us of not being an English department anymore. But somebody's got to be reading these people if they don't have a home anymore. I imagine your father probably fits. I mean, I imagine there's more people reading him in English departments than in economics.
Well, and indeed, he was elected president of the American Association of Arts and Letters sometime after he had been president of the American Economics Association, but then it was beginning to be erased like Trotsky from the photograph. to tell a story about a dinner, the centenary dinner of the American Economic Association, which I think was around 1983, maybe. All the past presidents who were still around were invited, and my parents went and saw my mother sometime after. I said, "Well, how was the dinner?" She said, "Not very nice." I said, "Really? What happened?" She said, "I got into..." My mother, of course, was a... had... my parents had spent 2 years in India, and she knew a lot about India. She said, "I got into an argument with a nasty little Swede about the Bofor scandal," which was a Swedish arms sales to India with, involving kickbacks. It had been in the news and had somewhat had greatly tarnished, for people who were paying attention, the reputation of, let's say, Swedish industrialists for being, you know, the kind of upright people you wouldn't want to rely on. Anyway, she said, "I got into an argument with a nasty little Swede." I said, "Oh, mother, what is the name of that nasty little Swede?" She said, "Oh, I don't remember, something like Lindbeck." I said, "Oh, mother, there goes the Nobel Prize." And she said, "Oh, well," she said, "Oh, well, it was worth it."
Oh, that's a great story. I think lest we just go into a conversation that I'm enjoying, but doesn't bring us back to the topic of debt. I wondered if you could...
That's your job, is to keep me going into the the channels that you want to go in. Go ahead.
Well, it's not... I mean, but the problem is, it's not necessarily the channels I want to go in. But I mean, I'm enjoying this very much. But we should talk about debt a bit more before our time closes. And I'm just thinking that the analysis you're describing, all of it comes together perfectly to give us an understanding of what happened in whatever we're calling it now, the housing crisis, the 2008 crisis. It was a system totally divorced from the real world and the real processes, except in some ways built on something real, which was people's housing, cloaked in impenetrable mathematics. And then once it was cloaked in this mathematics, it became this sort of insular system in which people's houses were traded more or less infinitely, and some substantial portion of the world's economy was just based on buying and selling imaginary pieces of people's houses, or rather the debt that they owed on these houses. It was worse than that. Good.
I think the person to really rely on and refer to in this is William K. Black, who you might would be an excellent guest, by the way, for you. Bill was the general counsel for the Federal Home Loan Bank Board and for the Savings and Loan Insurance Corporation, FISLIC in San Francisco, litigator, who saw the savings and loan crisis and understood in the 1980s that the problem here was criminal takeover of the industry. And through that point of view and that understanding, he was a lawyer and an economist, and still is. He blew the whistle on the S&L crisis, and he understood the fraudulent basis of the mortgage-backed securities, which were designed in such a way as to leave the fraudulent documentation, the liar's loans, the forgeries, the missing documentation, the fact that loans were being made to people who were being chosen because they would not be able to pay them back, and then sliced and diced in such a way that they could get corrupt ratings from the ratings agencies and then sold on to the ultimate fool, who was often a European bank or pension fund or any number of entities, with toxic waste in the form of these equity tranches remaining in the portfolio of the banking system, all of the structure, which is simply invisible to the mainstream economists because they don't see things in terms of legal documents that have to have a certain integrity, and they don't see things in terms of the potential for fraud because they told themselves that the markets would not permit fraud, and people, the reputational effects would be such that banks and so forth wouldn't engage in this behavior, when everybody who was close to the industry and everybody who approached it from a regulator standpoint understood very well that was exactly what was happening, and that was happening in part because the regulatory process had been dismantled deliberately beginning in the 1990s, well, in the 1970s, actually, but with the major steps in the 1990s under Clinton and in the early 2000s when Bush pulled the FBI off of the case of financial regulation. This was all very deliberate. It would happen. It facilitated a period of apparently rapid growth with an inevitable crash, which unfortunately for the Bush people happened before the end of their watch, was probably the only thing that really bothered them, is that they didn't quite escape with their reputations intact. There are many excellent treatments of this. The film Inside Job, I think, is really first rate. But also the film on Michael Lewis's book, The Big Short, is an indispensable thing to, for people to watch. And it explains this all pretty well. What it really shows is the extent to which the academic economists were, in many cases, if they weren't out to lunch, they might have been complicit in failing to understand and call the situation. So it's, but did anybody pay any penalty professionally for this? No. Did any academic department, did anybody resign a professorship over it? Not that I'm aware of. Did any of these departments ever hire anybody who had foreseen correctly what was happening? Did they come into, were they taken up by Harvard or Princeton or Columbia or any of these departments? I think the answer to that is, again, no. You just had a profession which has tried to turn the page on this and to move on as though they had not been caught in a really outrageous act of professional misfeasance, which had vast consequences for the American population in general. The role of mathematics, well, again, another small story. In 2010, I was, by a really very great stroke of luck, I was invited to a conference in Italy, very small conference in Umbria near Perugia in a small private hotel. It was a conference sponsored by some friends of mine from Russia, academicians. The chair of the conference was none other than Mikhail Sergeyevich Gorbachev. A dozen Russians, one Italian, myself, and Gorbachev. And I prepared a paper for it. And I began my paper by saying, you know, Mr. President, when Homer returns to tell the story of our time, he will say that the Russian mathematicians set forth from the gates of Muscovy in 1992 and presented themselves before Wall Street, bearing the gift of quantitative risk management models, that they were received with joy, and they came inside and went to work, and in less than 20 years, they successfully destroyed the whole place, that this was the greatest Trojan horse operation since Troy. And Mr. President, I said, in history, you will be credited not only with the end of Soviet communism, but also with the collapse of Western financial capitalism. And he looked at me and said, I've been accused of worse.
James, I had to follow up on that. I mean, what, this was close to 15 years ago now, or 10 years ago. We don't seem to be seeing it just seems to keep happening. How does the system just keep running itself? Or do you think there's change
because
coming?
It's in the nature of the system to try and obliterate the memory and the safeguards, to erode the safeguards that are established after one such episodes in order to permit it to happen again. Reading, by the way, just a very excellent Harvard history PhD that's just been filed. The author is Tim Barker. Can't recommend it too highly, although it's still not available. It's just been, I don't think it's even final edits. But it's a history of the Cold War, of military Keynesianism and its role. And one of the points he makes toward the end is that at a certain moment when the Cold War came to an end and there was, for at least time, a smaller reliance on direct government spending through the military, what did we get? We got an asset-based economy driven by the financial system, which is exactly what we'd had, more or less exactly what we had in the 1920s. And that system, which is based upon, come back to Graeber, on the accumulation of private debts, gives you a certain kind of economic activity. It gives you real estate activity in particular, and employment in the services sector is an offshoot of that. Well, you don't have to worry about complex things like manufacturing because competent countries like China and Japan and Korea have taken those over and run, you know, have the organization and technical ability to keep them going. So long as they're willing to send them stuff in return for U.S. government debt, everything is fine. Now, if they stop, well, it won't be so fine, but sufficient unto the day. In any event, so we have this kind of unbalanced economy with finance, information technology controlling narratives, real estate, some energy activity is a major things that the United States does. And of course, anything that's run out of a very thin basis of financial elites combined with the people who are giving us artificial intelligence, which is not as good as the real thing, is going to be unstable. And how do you know that all the money that's going into AI is going into firms which are going to do something that's actually useful. Well, as long as the money's going in, you don't need to really care very much because that's generating activity by itself. But when you actually start asking, is anybody ever going to buy the product or is it going to do anything that's, you know, that's going to make your life better? Chances are you're going to come into a rather unpleasant realization that once again, you failed to build up the physical structures that you will need in the next generation. And so the infrastructure continues to deteriorate, as anybody who passes through an airport in the United States, or let alone a railway station, let alone trying to deal with, for example, the Texas electricity grid in midwinter or midsummer, you know, so we're not keeping up.
I mean, this takes us back to this sterility, because I've had this conversation with economist James, and their response is sort of like, well, if the numbers say that there's lots of money in the U.S. economy, then that means the U.S. economy is good. And if you try and point to something outside of GDP and say, look, you can see the grid is falling apart. Look, you can see that the planes are crashing into each other. Look, you can see that children are starving. Their response is like, well, that's not what I'm seeing in the numbers. And the numbers somehow are the real thing, not the real world. Does this sound
right? I think you put your finger on something very important, which is that we have come to the point where we have reified a set of statistics, which are now practically a century old and thoroughly past their useful date. What happened here? In the 1930s, under the leadership of people like Simon Kuznets, and in response in part to Keynes, we would develop the system of national income accounts. It was a very useful thing to do. It provided both the basis for understanding what you had to do, at least up to a point, to manage the massive mobilization in the Second World War, where you doubled the flow of funds and you needed to have outlets for those funds so that they didn't generate runaway inflation. And you needed the price controls that my father administered. All of that then translated in the post-war period to a kind of managerial idea that you could just use the needle valves, as my old boss Henry Royce called them, of monetary and fiscal policy to control this machine that would continue to function for you. And that was basically it. And that idea, which was already ossified by the 1960s, continues to be the basic notion that conventional economists mostly have. They have lost the ability to see where the pipes go and what kind of rust and scale they've acquired and what kind of maintenance they need. They're not really competent as plumbers, but they continue to think if you twiddle the hot and the cold, you'll get the water out in the right combination. That's what they're measuring. Really, it's a profession, which again, is, I think, goes back to its intellectual isolation from physics, engineering, and the other sort of heart. In some cases, you have to say, okay, intellectual leadership of economics is located in the Ivy Leagues by and large and in other places like the University of Chicago. Do these universities, do they do a lot of agricultural and mechanical work? Do they do a lot of scientific work? The answer to that is, that's not their main thing by and large. Maybe they have a good medical school, but that's not where your petroleum engineers and your railroad people are coming from. So there's just a disconnect in all kinds of ways, and the economists simply don't know what the economists of that previous generation had to know. Again, I keep telling you stories, but I have a large fund of them. I asked my father once how he found 17,000 people in early 1942, right after Pearl Harbor, to staff the Office of Price Administration. I mean, it was set up in just a few months. Oh, he said, land-grant colleges. I hired all the economics departments. They knew everything they needed to know about their local areas and industry, the agriculture, and so forth. That's what they did. They were too old to fight. They wanted to do something and just brought them all in. It's not entirely true. There were lots of other very interesting people at the OPA, lawyers and people like Jessica Mitford, even flamboyant American communist of British origin, Mitford sisters. Essentially, that's what you're looking at, is what there was a competence about the functioning of the actual economy. Does a professor who wants tenure in a top department in the United States study agriculture or industry or, for that matter, energy processes? Is that what they do? No. maybe they have to master the general equilibrium, the dynamic stochastic general equilibrium model, and then they pretend that they know something, or some set of econometric techniques, and they pretend they know something as a result of that. So you have this combination of statistics that people don't understand and techniques which have become the priority in there in anything they do that's applied. Good luck trying to cope with the real world with that toolkit.
We're running out of time, I guess. So I'm going to throw an impossible question at you, and you don't have to answer it. What do we need to do? Do we need to get the economists to encounter history and empiricism? Do we need to kick the economists out of the government? How do we get out of this stasis?
I've given some thought to this, and if I had the ability to do it, I would say the universities need to set up alternate and parallel tracks in which people who have useful and relevant capacities and who are thinking in modern and scientific terms can take over large parts of the instruction. Now, to some extent, I wouldn't say it doesn't happen to some extent in business schools, but they have another set of problems, which is they tend to be very right wing. That's sort of what you need. You can't rely on a discipline which has closed itself off to reform itself. And of course, you can't fire them, but you can, generally speaking, allow them to phase themselves out, not to encourage that everybody has to take their classes and maintain themselves as economic entities within the academic space. If I ran the zoo, that's what I would try to do. And I would insist that people who've made reputations and who are right, and I can name, my friends who are MMT, Stephanie Kelton, for example, other people who have done really excellent work. I've been a great fan of Isabella Weber, just got tenure at UMass Amherst. Clara Matai just got tenure at the New School. So there are people out there who are capable of doing excellent work. And, they're in good places. I'm not saying that UMass should give up Isabella or that she should go someplace else. But why aren't all of these really rich and powerful institutions, why aren't they getting the same caliber people? Why aren't they seeking them out? Why aren't they hiring them? That's the question. As long as they keep on insisting that you have to conform to the framework of, let's say, what they call the five top journals, two of which, as Angus Deaton has pointed out in his new book, are house journals of Harvard and Chicago. If that's the case, you get tenure in a competitive department. You have to be on the good side of the editors of those five journals. You're never going to get anywhere. You're just going to end up reproducing the same sterile stuff and pretending that you're making progress with sort of little bits of differentiation here and there. So something else has to be done, and the resources for it have to come from the outside. Maybe from if the national government had the right idea, you would set up a parallel foundation, social science, economic science foundation, and staff it with people who are really singing out to revive and restore a competent and relevant study of a critical study of the way economies actually work.
That's so interesting. It seems to me that the opposite is happening. And when people like Graeber pop up with alternative accounts of what the field of economics is ostensibly studying, the result is
they get chased
dismissal
out.
Sure. Almost. Yeah.
Sure. They get chased out. Well, that's the process. That's the process that should be confronted. I'm not optimistic that it can happen, but if you want to have a population down the road that can cope with the problems that we're going to have and that we are having, you need to think about whether your existing institutions are suited to that. And it's clear that in the case of the economics profession, there is actually a gigantic obstacle to that goal.
I mean, I'll return to your, look, James, something is going to happen. The law of entropy says that the system isn't going to keep going as it is. The question is whether we're going to prepare ourselves so that the people who are making these decisions and who have to have the job of reconstructing a system understand the world and how to make it a better place for more people, or whether it's just going to blow up in our faces. I mean, that's the, those are the two options.
You could be quoting verbatim the conclusion of the Galbraith Chen book. That's exactly it. And it's entirely possible that some other society will, with a more realistic view and a different set of pathways to influence in the way it's governed, will beat us to it. if you're running a society on fundamentally on principles that are fundamentally counter to the proper function of the real world, and somebody else isn't, don't expect to stay in a leading position. Well, you can see this is happening. It's happening in front of our faces, actually. We're falling all over ourselves with beliefs about the superiority of our system, and industrially as well as militarily. Well, we're coming up against some pretty hard lessons. That's where we are. We need to realize this.
I mean, perhaps I'm wrong or overly optimistic. I do not detect, with the people I talk to at least, any confidence remaining in the economic consensus. I do think something is coming, but that's why you and I are here talking, because I'm looking for something different and I'm looking for alternatives. I'm so glad you're out there doing this work, James.
I won't share your optimism, but I would try not to discourage you from working on that basis, because ultimately the optimists will be the ones who actually achieve something in the world.
Well, the alternative is despair, and I'm just not interested in
begging to differ. I come back to the phrase that's a little abbreviation of something that it's attributed to William of Orange, that it is not necessary to hope in order to persevere.
I'm happy to persevere one way or another.
I sent this to my daughter a couple of days ago, who's deeply involved in the protest movement out in her college in California, with an instruction that she's really doing an extraordinary job, but that she did need it to occasionally get some rest. And she came back with a version that said, "Emma of Austin, it is necessary to nap in order to persevere."
Yeah, I will even add this phrase, self-care, has been debased, but it actually comes, it's an idea from Audre Lorde that says, you, in order to prosecute the struggle, self-care does not mean you should buy yourself something because you're stressed out from your corporate job. It means that you're no use to anyone else in the fight to make the world a better place.
We're all subject to the entropy law, and we all have to maintain be able to tap into low entropy resources and to maintain our systems. Otherwise, we get run down. This is why people don't live forever. But it's also why we tend to pass on our lesson to younger people whose entropy is lower than ours, and who can carry things forward.
You and I at universities, we have no shortage of younger people. Absolutely.
And no,
James, is there anything else?
And like a deep surplus of older ones, but that's
well, that's, you know, that will change in time.
Yeah, that's true.
Thank you so much for this. What else? Anything else you want to say before we go?
No, this is fine. Great. I really enjoyed the conversation very much. And strength to your arm.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.